ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
50 years ago, on the 11th of November, a political earthquake erupted.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen.
It's the most famous chapter in our political history, and the fallout is still with us today. Hear the whole gripping story of the dismissal, unfolded scene by shocking scene, in our award-winning podcast, The 11th.
He looked at me and said, I owe history nothing.
Search for The 11th on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal land. The favelas of Rio de Janeiro, the shanty towns that ring that city, are run by gangs trafficking in drugs and arms, places of endless violence. But so brutal have recent police operations been in the favelas that questions are being asked now about what's going on in leftist Brazil as it hosts world leaders for COP30. In Melbourne, we're going to celebrate the 70th birthday of the oldest surviving computer in the world. The computer weighs tons and is lovingly cared for at Melbourne University. Our guest, Dr. Peter Thorne, was a schoolboy when he first came face to face with this huge contraption of wires and valves. He's now 85 with an AO for significant services to computer science, education and to history. But first to Ian Dunt in the UK, columnist with iNews, co-host of the Origin Story podcast, and right now totally engrossed by the crisis at the BBC. Ian, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Ian, last Sunday, the Director General of the BBC, Tim Davey, and the Chief Executive of News, Deborah Turness, resigned. Do we yet know exactly why?
No. The mechanism... The series of events is very confused, very mysterious, and very febrile, and is now sort of being tugged at by both sides. I'm simplifying here, but basically by a sort of liberal progressive side and a reactionary populist side, in order to justify their version of events and their assessment of what the BBC is like. But the fundamental moment that they left, either of their own accord or because they were forced out, is very unclear. The position on the sort of liberal side, the accusation, which essentially says that a kind of coup was raised against them within the BBC, is that members of the BBC board, and in particular a man called Robbie Gibb, who was placed there by Boris Johnson as prime minister and has worked as this kind of sort of the center for the sort of right-wing sabotage within the BBC. He sits within the BBC but tries to destroy it, was responsible for forcing them out of position. The other view is just that they stepped down because of the accusations against the quality of BBC journalism were so severe that they felt that they couldn't stand by their position. We do not know which of those stories is correct.
At some stage, I presume, they're both going to sort of put out a statement, make some kind of explanation.
Yeah, you'd think so, wouldn't you?
Well, but
you
know what? Especially when you're running a press organisation.
I would have thought that makes them less likely to be transparent and clear-spoken. It's weird, you know, the history of the BBC is actually terrible for this sort of thing. I mean, that, you know, in the 80s, Milne, who was running the BBC at that point, was the director general at that stage, was forced out by Margaret Thatcher's choice, Marmaduke Hussey. And that, again, took place in exactly the same way. It was sort of like no one ever really found out what happened afterwards. You know, they'd write memoirs, you know, 5 years later and go like, well, actually, I called him in for a meeting after the board and sort of said it was time for him to pop off. Like, it's quite, I mean, it's actually unbelievable. They use license fee money. It's public money. You know, it is under a charter that is governed by Parliament democratically. And yet when it comes down to these really quite key decisions, it's very, very opaque the way that they're made at the BBC.
Well, look, let's go to what the accusations are against the BBC. Last year, the Panorama broadcast an episode called Trump, A Second Chance. And in it, and nobody seems to question this for a moment, in it, they spliced two quotes from Trump on the day of the storming of the Capitol. They spliced them together in a really quite outrageous way. And I'm wondering whether anybody until now has complained about that.
No. No, but then that's the BBC. Where, I mean, look, every time there's a scandal about the BBC, we had the same with Russell Brand's, you know, we lost an entire summer about a phone call that a comedian, Russell Brand, made to the uncle of a woman that he slept with as the sort of moment of moral depravity. I mean, again, hardly anyone had heard the thing when it first went out. The Iraq dossier, which really sort of decapitated the BBC during the Iraq war in 2003, that was about a news report that went out at 5:15 a.m. You know, no one ever really hears the original thing. It's about the coverage. So oddly enough, it's usually the right-wing press coverage of something, their outrage, brings it to a much larger audience, and then people hear it and they complain. Hardly anyone noticed at the time. I also want to be cautious about what happened here. You're right. We all know the speech. It's the Trump speech before the insurrection. And they took a quote from one bit and a quote from another bit that made it look like he was sort of like offering to lead the crowd. When in fact, that you know, they were separate. I mean, you and I both know journalistically, like you have to be really careful when you're taking excerpts. And yet there's two things you have to be careful of. First, you have to be careful is to show that you are taking excerpts, which you do, you know, in written copy by using the ellipsis, by using dot, dot, dot. But you do usually on screen by just flashing white for a moment so that you can see it's taken from two bits. They didn't do that. And the other bit is you have to be careful when you've extracted a bit of commentary to make it clear to the reader if the bits that you're using would change the meaning by virtue of the bit that was removed. They didn't do that. It's bad. It's very sloppy. It's dodgy. And it deserves probably a bit more than a slap on the wrist. Certainly to take it to the point that's being taken now, which is that this would warrant the resignation of a director general, and that this can be used as a description of the whole of the BBC as biased and corrupt and part of fake news and all of that is preposterous and absurd. But the moment itself was quite sloppy.
Who is Michael Prescott?
Excellent question, to which we all want to know the answer. He's a former right-wing journalist, used to work for The Times as a Murdoch guy, really, now runs a PR agency. He was brought in to advise the BBC on editorial by Robbie Gibb, who I mentioned earlier. So, you know, this figure brought in by Boris Johnson in order to try and sort of undermine the BBC from within, really. Boris Johnson did this to all sorts of institutions, including the Equality and Human Rights Commission. Wherever he could see a spot that he could just bring in a quite right-wing figure and insert them in, he would use his power to do that. That's what Robbie Gibb does. Robbie Gibb then brings in Prescott. Prescott writes this memo, basically says, You've messed up on this Trump quote. You're completely pro-trans. They're always obsessed with trans on the right wing of the culture war. That really doesn't stand up at all.
And poofs, they're also terribly worried about homosexuals, aren't they, as well?
Yeah, no, exactly.
And they should be. They should be, but yes.
It's a terrible danger to our society. But that always, I mean, it's always this flashing warning sight when the trans issue comes up, because it's always there somewhere. That's just completely wrong. The BBC has very, very robust debates on that issue, very robust. And then he spoke about, you know, there were some instances where BBC Arabic had featured someone commenting who it ended up had a connection with Hamas. So again, this is the sort of thing that you can do with the BBC very effectively. And the reason you can do it is because of the sheer amount of content that it puts out. As I'm speaking to you, hundreds of hours of BBC content will have been made real because of so many channels, so many local news stations, so many national news stations just on radio alone. I mean, you're talking sort of six on national, obviously dozens and dozens on local. Then, you know, BBC World Service, the BBC News Channel on all the time, and then the broadcast stations and iPlayer. It's just churning out content. So you can write a report that says, look at this liberal bias and find three instances. Here's a Trump speech. You know, here's something that happened on BBC Arabic, and here's a trans report. But of course, if you were to take that as a data set compared to the output that the BBC puts out over the period he's looking at, years, it would look like specks of sand on the beach. And yet, because of the quantity of output, you can tell that story. And that's what he did in the memo. He told that story. And that memo now sits like a ticking bomb in the middle of the debate that is taking place.
But just on the BBC Arabic, you concede, but that may not be the word, but there have been problems there and that the BBC was addressing those problems.
Yeah, that's right. So it's more than once. I mean, it's on regular occasions they used commentators who they clearly hadn't done the proper checks with. So, I mean, they already had internal investigations into what was going on at BBC Arabic. But again, you would want some caution. You know, I mean, the trouble is they got into an awful lot of bother over a fundamentally semantic argument over Gaza, which was that they wouldn't call Hamas terrorists. They called them militants for some particular, you know, editorial code that they had, basically a sort of design code. And sort of said, well, we don't use that term for this kind of group. We only use it for officially prescribed groups and blah, blah, blah. The right went completely nuts over this, as if to say that all their coverage was innately anti-Israel. I mean, it is just an absurd position to put. Like, the BBC does often a pretty poor job on big ticket issues. On Israel, Gaza, it sort of did what it could. I mean, you know, as hard as it was to report on that area, it actually did a fairly good, fairly even-handed job in its coverage. But it's part of an attack by the right, which is to say that it is hopelessly pro-Palestinian, it is hopelessly pro-trans, it is hopelessly anti-Donald Trump, it is hopelessly anti-Brexit. I mean, you can imagine, you know, the position that they're trying to put across. And there were instances that they could use in BBC Arabic that helped to buttress that point.
I probably don't need to say to you, but this strategy is familiar to Australians, and the difficulty of populist politicians is also familiar to Australians, because the BBC is the most trusted news outlet in the UK. Is that not right? By a long way. And I understand it's the second most trusted news outlet in the United States.
That's correct as well.
And the ABC in Australia, of course, is by a long way the most trusted news source in Australia. The problem here for the people who are applauding what's going on in London at the moment is that the ideas that people trust don't seem to be the ideas that, say, the Daily Telegraph in London is anxious to promote. There's a bit of a gap there, isn't there?
Yeah, I think that there's... There is a recognition on the populist right that objective values in journalism and culture at large are very dangerous to the project. So I think the attack on the BBC is very similar to the attack that you see on universities in the US, but you also see it in the UK, daily attacks on universities and on think tanks and scientific and historical institutions. You know, so I mean, for instance, the National Trust, which, you know, owns a bunch of sort of old sort of mansion properties in the UK, historic properties, whenever they sort of have any kind of report on the use of funding around slavery for how these houses were maintained, which they feel they need to do, you know, as the custodians of those properties.
Because so many of them were built on slave money, yes.
On the money. Of course, exactly, yeah.
God's slave money led to some beautiful architecture, didn't it?
Yes.
But that's a subject for another day.
So on that basis, they're vigorously attacked. So you look at it and you think, well, okay, so there's a pattern here, right? And it's like, I mean, for instance, you know, we were hearing US journalists, pro-Trump journalists on the BBC this morning. I mean, the BBC loves taking on people who basically want to murder it, give their views. And they would sort of sit there and say, we're telling you the BBC is biased and my friend Donald Trump is going to take it out. And you think, like, you're a journalist. You're saying that it's your friend, Donald Trump, and you dare to accuse anyone else of bias. Because, of course, it is not really objectivity or lack of bias that they want. What they want is complete subservience to the right-wing populist viewpoint. Now, and those institutions which hold out then come under attack.
Now, Donald Trump, in a trademark way, is saying that if the BBC gives him personally money, he won't sue them. Do we know how much the payoff is supposed to be? Will it be paid, do you reckon?
I don't know the answer to that question. That's very difficult. Look, if it was UK libel, English and Welsh libel laws, he would have no hope at all. Because there's a sort of statute that basically says you've only got 1 year. I'm very, very aware of this as a journalist.
Yes, you know, after we one tend year, to know these rules.
Yeah, these are rules that I'm very familiar with. You know, after 1 year, you can't sue for libel. Because the argument for libel is that it damaged your reputation. If, you know, it's taken more than a year for you to notice that this thing has happened, by definition, it cannot have damaged your reputation, or else you would have heard of it already.
But there's more than time here, Ian. I mean, how damaged is the reputation of somebody who manages to be the President of the United States? I mean, yeah, well, it isn't standing, the whatever the BBC has done to him isn't standing in the way of him being able to run the United States, I would have thought. But look,
well, and we could go a step further than that, right? We could also say, how damaging is it, given that there were years preceding where he was extremely well documented to have carried out an attempt to subvert and undermine American democracy? That is a true thing that took place. We have to keep on telling ourselves, we're not going mad. You know, that is something that actually happened, even though now to say it out loud results in someone issuing legal threats. But he constructed a conspiracy theory, an extremist conspiracy theory, that he won the election, even though he, in fact, objectively and empirically lost it. Yep. He then spread that theory through social media and mainstream media channels. The crowd that acted that day did so and reported over and over again when they were asked questions during criminal proceedings that they were doing so, they believe, because Donald Trump was asking them to do it and that he would be there. They then tried to undermine American democracy themselves, inspired and motivated by the extremist conspiracy theory that he himself had invented and spread. So on that basis, the idea that after that series of events, he would be there. Yesterday, while he was threatening the BBC, he was, you know, protecting Rudy Giuliani, all the people that helped him try to undermine democracy. He protects those who actually covered the fact of what he did come under sustained attack. And in fact, you know, facing bankruptcy if he was to get the extent of the legal challenge for $1 billion that he claims to be looking for. So you do have to remind yourself of this stuff, or else you do feel like you are
going mad. Look, just in the 2 seconds we have left, could you report in on the celebrations in London, in and around Buckingham Palace, for the fabulous work the Crown did 50 years ago in Australia, sacking the Prime Minister Gough Whitlam? I mean, everybody's, you know, there are all the supporters out here say that the Governor General did nothing wrong whatever. So I presume there is fireworks, celebrations of some kind, perhaps editorials in the Daily Telegraph about the great work of the Crown.
Yeah, no, it's a special. We have it as a special bank holiday, and we all have barbecues and go surfing. So, I suppose, if it assists, you know, it is at least coming at a period where the royal family are having a bit of a rough old time of it over the Andrew.
Guess what? Princess Anne is out in Australia for the occasion. I mean, she isn't sort of. She's here. She's wearing a slouch hat. She looks fabulous. She's inspecting troops. It's tremendously exciting, but we have to stop. Oh, the people in the control room are making obscene gestures at me and telling me that this conversation has to stop. Ian, thank you once again for joining us on Late Night Live. I have been talking to Ian Dunt, columnist with iNews, co-host of the Origin Story podcast. Coming up, the police go wild in Rio. The gangs of Latin America are brutal, and so are the tactics police use against them. 2 weeks ago, more than 2,000 police and soldiers with drones, helicopters and armoured vehicles stormed the favelas of Rio de Janeiro at dawn to capture, they hoped, the leaders of the gang known as Comando Vermelho, the Red Command. The result was a slaughter that's provoked local and international rage. At a time when Brazil is presenting itself on the world stage as hosts of the COP Climate Summit. To explore this contradiction, we have turned to Ana Lankes, Brazil Bureau Chief of The Economist. And Ana joins us from Rio. Ana, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you for having me.
Ana, first, explain to us the favelas and why they are so enormous, so full of crime, et cetera, et cetera. What are they?
So the favelas are slums. They're high-density, low-income areas with mostly black or mixed-race residents. Brazil has a population of around 200 million people, and some 16 million, or 8% of the population, live in favelas. And some of these communities are run by criminal groups who extort locals and charge them for basic services like access to electricity, water, and gas. And they kill locals who disobey them. So they make the law in the regions that they control. So for example, if you're caught stealing without permission from a gang leader, you can be put in car tires and the tires set on fire. So favelas are often very dangerous places. And police, especially in Rio, feel that they have a license to go in and use extreme violence to put an end to the violence that goes on there.
Tell us about the Red Command.
So the Red Command is one of Brazil's oldest criminal groups. It was founded in the 1970s during Brazil's military dictatorship. And the dictatorship sent common criminals and persecuted leftists to a prison on an island here called Ilha Grande, or Big Island. It's like Alcatraz, but 10 times worse. And the conditions there were so terrible that these groups bandied together to form a kind of protection organization to protect each other from rape and assault within the prison and to share scarce resources. And pretty quickly, they dropped any pretense of like leftist ideology and just became a drug trafficking group. And this happened during the kind of first boom of the drug trade, the globalization of the drug trade in the 1980s. So today, the Red Command has around 30 to 40,000 members throughout Brazil, and it has a very diversified portfolio. So they do drug trafficking, but they also are involved in arms trafficking, selling counterfeit cigarettes and spirits, mining illegal gold, fuel theft, all sorts of things. So we don't know exactly how much they make, but it's thought to be, you know, in the hundreds of millions or billions a year.
Is there any sort of informal relationship between these gangs and the government?
Oh, yeah. I mean, sometimes it's not even informal. So the only reason that these gangs can survive is because they have links not just to the government, but to security forces in Rio. So I'll give you like a quick map of gangs in Rio. So you have...
Great.
You have like the Red Command, but you also have lots of little other gangs, and you have militias, so paramilitary groups that were founded by retired police officers and soldiers to combat the drug gangs. And then they themselves became extortionists and drug traffickers. So the militias, which are the ones founded by former police officers, often have very close ties to politicians. And actually, one of the politicians they're thought to have some sort of friendly relationship with is Jair Bolsonaro and his sons. Jair Bolsonaro was Brazil's former president.
The great friend of Donald Trump.
Yeah, the great friend of Donald Trump, who's just been sentenced to 27 years in prison for organizing a coup. So the militias and the drug gangs try to get people elected to the local government in Rio so that they can, you know, rule with impunity. And another thing is that the gangs and the militias often only have the weapons that they have, and these are war, you know, warlike weapons, because corrupted police officers and soldiers sell them these weapons. So there's all sorts of complicated relationships between the gangs, the militias, politicians, security forces, and that makes it really hard to go after these groups.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Anna Lankes, The Economist's Brazil bureau chief, about the gangs of the favelas of Rio. Anna, these close links make me wonder why something like Operation Containment was even mounted.
So that's a good question. I mean, there are links to links between politicians and gangs. There are also some, you know, obviously good people trying to get rid of the gangs. But in this case, Operation Contention, it looks like a very politically motivated operation. So next year, Brazil hosts a general election. It's a huge election. So, you know, half of the Senate will be renewed and all of the lower seats in Congress and lots of the state legislatives and the governors of Brazil's 27 states. And the governor of Rio, Cláudio Castro, he can't run for re-election as governor. So he wants a seat in the Senate. And his approval ratings were not looking so great. And I think he basically just needed like something to give his campaign a bit of mojo, a bit of oomph. And this is that. I mean, what these operations generate is, you know, headlines. People love them. They're real like crowd pleasers. The rest of the world and human rights groups were horrified by the violence that was used by the police in this last operation. But more than half of Brazilians supported it, and more than 80% of favela residents supported this operation. So I think that this is politically motivated. Another important thing to mention is that, like I said, Jair Bolsonaro, he was a former president, and he's kind of the leader of the right, but he was just sentenced to jail. So the right is a little bit adrift. And I think they figured out that crime is voters' main issue and that the left-wing government is seen as soft on crime. So I think that this will be their main thing going into the election next year. Next year is people will also choose the president. So I think this is very political.
Tell us what we know of the police action in this operation. How many people were killed? What was the upshot of it all?
So what happened was that the operation, they were supposed to carry out 100 arrest warrants against members of the Red Command, who they'd been tracking for several months after a tip-off by an anonymous whistleblower. And so they had 100 arrest warrants issued by Rio's public prosecutor. And they were supposed to go after Doca, who's the head of the Red Command. So those were like the aims of the raid. But instead, what happened is that it got really messy and it became like a bloodbath. Like there were scenes of urban warfare. So as the police approached the neighborhood, and you mentioned the number in your intro, there were 2,500 military and civil police officers. So as they entered the neighborhood, the gangs tried to slow their entry by setting cars and buses alight to create barricades. And the gangs launched grenades from drones. I mean, it tells you the kinds of weapons that they have. So they launched grenades from drones. Many people from the favela started running away into the nearby jungle, many of the suspects. But police officers from the special operations unit were waiting for them at the top of the hill, and they shot anyone running there. So all in all, four police officers were killed. One of them had just been trained. This was like his first operation. So four police officers were killed and at least 117 inhabitants of the favela. And another 120-odd people were arrested. So this was the most lethal police raid in Brazilian history, which is a country very accustomed to extreme police violence. One thing that Rio security forces have said is that most of the people killed had proven links to the Red Command. So like 100 of them had criminal records, 60 of them had active arrest warrants. And police also captured, you know, 200 kilograms of cocaine, 100 rifles. And nine like big regional leaders of the Red Command were killed or arrested. But the main guy, Doca, managed to escape. So in some ways, you know, it failed. And the brutality of it really left a lot of people, especially in the human rights world, with a very bad taste in their mouth. I mean, in one case, a 19-year-old was effectively decapitated. His head was blown off because he was shot at such close range. And a third of the victims were under the age of 25. You know, one was 14, another was 17. And then the way the police did it, you know, they killed all these people in the jungle. The official death toll on the first day was 64 people. And then the relatives of those who'd been killed went into the jungle and came out with so many bodies that the death toll within a day was, you know, 117. So what this tells you is that the police in Rio often don't do a very good job. They don't clean up the crime scenes. They don't keep forensic evidence. They just left the bodies there, and the bodies were recovered by the residents themselves. There's also questions about whether some of these were summary executions because yes, some people had their hands tied, you know, this kind of thing.
Yep.
So
yep.
More information and evidence needs to be presented before we know what really happened.
Anna, is there an argument that So powerful are these gangs that this is not civil policing as we understand it, that it is more like warfare.
So that's interesting that you ask that, because that is what the government of Rio and what Donald Trump want to, that's how they want to describe this. They want these groups to be officially labeled as narco-terrorist groups. And after the police operation, Argentina and Paraguay, which both have right-wing governments cozy with Trump, labeled the Red Command and their main rival in Brazil as terrorist organizations. But I think there's an important distinction to be made. So far, Brazil's government has refused to call these terrorist organizations because under Brazilian law, terrorists need to have political ends, and they have to have ideological, ethnic, or religious motivation to cause that terror. Whereas in the case of the drug gangs, they are terrifying and they exercise quite a lot of political control in their neighborhoods, but the main objective is profit. They just want to make money. And as a result of that money, they can corrupt some institutions. But that doesn't mean that their main motivation is political.
This is business.
Yeah, exactly. This is business. And as long as there's a market for drugs and arms and whatever, they will exist.
I understand that the president of Brazil was shocked by this raid. But is there any possibility that there will be an inquiry or a commission of some kind to investigate what's gone on?
Yes and no. I mean, yes, because the Supreme Court has asked Rio security forces to provide like much more information, including videos from body cameras and forensic evidence of the bodies that were, you know, retrieved in the forest, and more information on the arrest warrants that were issued before the raid. So the Supreme Court has been asking for way more information. Also, the day after the operation, the Senate opened a parliamentary inquiry on organized crime to kind of find out more about how organized crime works in the country. And the federal police sent some forensic analysts. So there's, you know, we'll probably find out more in the next few weeks. But the truth is that police violence is really, really common in Brazil, and especially Rio. And every time these kinds of massacres happen, there are some court rulings and there's, you know, some intent to find out what really happened. And then it all goes back to the way it was. And there's another violent police operation, and people clap their hands and they really like it. So nothing really changes. Just to give you an example, there were two really important court rulings in recent years on police violence in Brazil. One in 2017 from the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, and one in 2020 from Brazil's Supreme Court. They basically ordered the police to like wear body cameras and make sure that police abuses were investigated by an independent body rather than the police themselves. And like, that just didn't really happen. It's basically ignored.
Yep, yep. Is it true that the police are paid bonuses for killing people?
Yeah, so this is totally mad. In September, Rio State Legislature passed a bill that would pay like huge bonuses to police who kill suspects in raids. So that's obviously just an incentive to kill people. But also there's a recent law that like gives a bonus to people who seize weapons during raids. But as I've already mentioned, many of the weapons in the hands of the gangs are sold to the gangs by corrupt, you know, police officials or people in the security forces. So that's another incentive to just sell them more weapons. So this stuff is just ridiculous. And it only happens because they're crowd pleasers. A kind of Wild West bounty goes down well with people, but it doesn't actually work. These kinds of police operations are very common in Latin America, where rulers like to govern with an iron fist, but they're super ineffective.
This is not just a matter of Brazil.
No, this is very common in the region. There's a lot of like what you can call security populism. So leaders like to use what's called mano dura, which means iron fist. And what that involves is like calling a state of emergency, sending the army onto the streets and into prisons, you know, suspending civil liberties for a while, this kind of thing, throwing loads of people in jail, like pre-trial detention. But a lot of the time, these tactics just make the problem worse, even as they appear to solve it. So I'll give you an example. It's very common in Latin America to like throw people in jail. without like having convicted them first. So they're just, it's pretrial detention. And this means that the prisons are mega overcrowded. Like in almost every country in Latin America, in the past 20 years, the population of the prisons has grown much more than like normal population growth in the actual population. And prisons are like recruiting grounds for the gangs, because in order to survive in a terrible prison in Latin America, you have to join a gang.
Yes.
So the gangs are just swelling. I mean, this is really counterproductive stuff.
And people love these raids. They're not perturbed by the raids.
No, and you know what? I kind of, sometimes the discourse of like the left and the government here in Brazil can be really annoying for people who experience the violence of these gangs every day. Who live with it. Because, you know, the response of the left is usually to say, oh, we need to invest in education and development in the favelas so that people are not recruited. Yes, sure, that's true. But that doesn't solve the issue right now, which is that there's extreme violence in the favelas and people who are just trying to go about their daily lives are victims of it. So you need to have a smarter approach that uses more intelligence and is more targeted. And especially that goes after the money made by the gangs. That really hurts them. You know, where it hurts the most is the money, because that's the only reason they exist.
It's a business.
Exactly. And it's a huge amount of money. So that's what they need to go after.
Anna, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live. I've been speaking to Anna Lancas, The Economist's Brazil Bureau Chief, about the violence of the favelas and the violence of the police. This is Late Night Live, and coming up, a birthday celebration for the oldest computer in the world. Australia's first computer, made at Sydney University in 1949, weighed a couple of tons and took a big truck to haul down to Melbourne a few years later, where it was named CSIRAC. Now that stands for Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation Automatic Computer. Peter Thorne was a school kid when he first saw CSIRAC on an expedition to visit Melbourne University. And it's a great pleasure to report that both have survived in fine shape, man and machine. Peter Thorne joins me now to celebrate the remarkable survival in working order of CSIRAC, one of the oldest computers in the world. Peter, welcome to Late Night Live.
Hello, nice to be talking to you.
Now, Peter, what do we mean when we talk about a computer in the late 1940s? Are we just talking about an electronic adding machine?
No, there was a big change, in fact, in the late 1940s. Up to that time, there were two real ways of doing calculations. One was to use a desk calculator where you wound a handle, push the keys, a bit like a cash register, push the keys, or possibly had an electric motor, and that meant that you could do one calculation perhaps every second if you were pretty good with the keyboard. The other was to build a very large mechanical or electromechanical machine, and you plugged cables into it whenever you wanted to change the task it was to do. In the 1940s, after the war, after the Second World War, it was realized that these things need to change. Firstly, you needed an electronic computer, which wasn't limited by mechanical speeds. And secondly, you needed to be able to program it, that was, give it instructions rather than just spend ages replugging it. And so a stored program electronic computer was the holy grail in the 1940s. And the computers we have today, of course, are stored program electronic computers, except today they have transistors, whereas in the 1940s they had to be built with vacuum tubes or valves, those things that used to glow in the back of radios.
I remember. Warm up the television, warm up the radio. But Peter, this machine that was made, this computer that was made at Sydney University in 1949 was a really early computer.
Yes, indeed it was. The background was that a young scientist by the name of Trevor Pearcey arrived in Australia in 1945, the end of 1945, straight after the war. He was about 26 at the time. At that stage, no stored program electronic computer worked anywhere in the world. He joined Radio Physics, which was within the grounds of Sydney University, but actually part of CSIR, later CSIRO. And I'm not quite sure how he managed this, but within a year or so, he said, we should build a stored program electronic computer. And they took on the task. He found an engineer, Maston Beard, and they started out to build this computer. Now, they designed it and started construction. It first operated its first stored program at the end of 1949, and by then there were only a couple of others in the world that had beaten it to the punch, one in England and possibly in the US. So this was, and you could argue whether it's the third, fourth, or fifth, depending on how you define it, stored program electronic computer to operate in the world. Done in Australia. In those days, we were along, there was no internet, there was no high-speed jet travel, so it was really a remarkable achievement.
How many of those computers, 3, 4, 5, 6, have survived?
None of them have survived. This one has. It's not actually operational, and because it had things like mercury inside it that you wouldn't want to have in a museum, but it is pretty much intact. The others were all dismantled, and in fact, what's happened in the United Kingdom is they've had to build replicas of their early computers to show what they did. We have an intact first-generation computer here, the only one in the world.
Didn't they understand what a remarkable historical object they had here? Why dismantle them?
Well, in the early days, they were pulling them apart and building new ones. And because this computer came to Melbourne, as you say, a few years after it first operated, where we put it to work and it worked for another 9 years, by the time it was turned off in 1964, we knew it was historic. We knew it was the only survivor of that first generation. So that's why it survived. The others got washed away in those successive waves we've seen in the whole computing era, where wave after wave of new technology has just swamped the previous waves.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live, I'm talking to Dr. Peter Thorne, who is the former head of the Department of Computer Science at the University of Melbourne, about this remarkable machine, CYRAC, that is still there, not in working order, but fully there, at the museum. Peter, I've got here the instructions for using the computer. I don't know whether you've got them handy, but can I read some of them? Procedure for using computer. 1, switch up wall switches 1 and 2. 2, wait 2 minutes. Clunk heard. 3, press white button on machine console. 4, wait 20 minutes. then we go on. And it just obviously took an enormously long time to just warm up.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, I was, when still a student, I hung around and made myself sort of useful. And I became the so-called weekend service engineer, which meant that I could do those early steps. If it didn't work, I couldn't fix it, to be honest. But one had to warm up those valves and before one started to use them. So one was turning on something that took 35 kilowatts of power. That's enough to really for a street load of houses. And you had to sort of let it stabilize before you actually put it to use. I suppose one can be irritated these days if it takes a few seconds for one's laptop to boot up. But
a millisecond.
20 minutes, yes. So, but once again, this was the wonder of the age. It was also, as you'll notice, a computer that you drove. It was something that you you sat and drove at the console.
It looks, in old photographs, a bit like the kind of thing that you'd expect on a disco night, sort of banks of switches. And I must say the men at the console do not look as though they're driving a disco night, but it's got that sort of feel to it. And in 1960, where is it? Yeah, 1960, the Age in Melbourne had this terrific story because the computer had been taught to sing.
Yes, well, in fact, after it was first operated in Sydney, it was programmed to play music, and we are now confident that that was the first digital music, the first computer music ever in history.
In the world?
In the world.
Wow.
And this has been reconstructed, this music, and scientific papers have been published about it. It really was the beginning, if you like, of multimedia in the sense that the computer could be programmed to play different songs. I must say it sounded a bit like a comb and paper or blowing a gum leaf, but nevertheless, it is recognisable as music. It was actually a brilliant piece of programming because you had to use the timing of the computer to generate notes which approximated musical tones. But that was one of the notable things about this computer. And, of course, there were quite a few firsts. And later at Melbourne, it was one of the first to do numerical weather forecasting, to actually generate weather models. It did really support science, Australian science, and in some cases Australian business. It did some work for banks and so on. So although these machines were primitive by today's standards, they were really important. And the computational laboratory, as it was called at the University of Melbourne, was fundamental in introducing computers and their potential here. And then later on, other computers came on and did that elsewhere. But that's the thing that we're celebrating later this month, is this establishment of a computer bureau, if you like, in Melbourne, and also setting up teaching of people how to program it and establishing research programs.
But Peter, the whiz who made the computer sing was a Professor Cherry. Did you know him?
Yes, Professor Cherry. Well, he was the person, he took over work that had been done in Sydney. And Professor Cherry was a professor of mathematics at the University of Melbourne and was one of the people who was instrumental in negotiating for it to come to the University of Melbourne when it left CSIRO in Sydney.
Oh, right.
But so he was fascinated with the machine, and he programmed it. He improved the music programming, which had already taken place and been demonstrated to an astounded international audience back in 1951.
But he had his doubts about the machine. The Age reported a bigger computer, Professor Cherry says, could be programmed in sound pulse patterns to speak with a human voice. But it would be a laborious process, he said, serving little apparent purpose.
Yes, yes. Well, there were quite a few quotes. Trevor Pearcey, who was a remarkable person, had a quote which I think was really quite prescient. This was published in 1948, early, before any store program computer had worked anywhere in the world. And he must have written it in late 1947 because it was published in a journal. And this is the quote. "It is not inconceivable that an automatic encyclopedic service operated through the national teleprinter or telephone system will one day exist."
Wikipedia.
Yes. Every time one does a search. I mean, that is quite extraordinary. In those days, of course, computers had very little storage capacity. The telephone system was very slow by to today's standards and the teleprinter system. But it was published by Trevor Pearcey in February 48 in a journal. So he must have written that in 47 before any store program computer worked anywhere.
There's wonderful stats that you've given us. Processing speed of CIRAC, 500 to 1,000 hertz. Laptop in 2018, that's years ago. Processing speed, 2.4 billion hertz. Memory capacity, 2,000 bytes for CIRAC. Laptop, 16.5 billion bytes. These are just so remarkable, aren't they?
They are indeed.
Power consumption, 30,000 watts. You were talking earlier about the immense amount of power it required. Laptop, 65 watts. Extraordinary.
Yes,
but
indeed.
Now, Peter, what about this as a task for these commemorations? Why not get CIRAC working again? Would that be possible?
Well,
I mean, what's a bit of mercury between scientists?
Oh, well, that's a question that I'm asked, in fact, quite a bit. But the problem is that it's currently the only original machine non-working. If we did we'd have to change update a lot of the wiring where the insulation would have rotted away over the years, just decayed. We couldn't use the original mercury memory for all kinds of health and safety reasons. So let's assume we did it. In a few years of effort, we would perhaps get it working. And then the people who have the capability of maintaining it, and it took two engineers to do it, would fall off the twig. And then we'd probably end up with a non-working, non-original machine.
Oh, the pessimism of you people is just appalling, appalling. But, of course, the valves. I mean, does anybody make those valves anymore?
Yes, you can get valves.
Oh, you can?
Yes. Russia, though, quite a lot of them, and in peaceful times, are sourceable from Russia for some reason.
Well, they've got all those wireless sets out in the tundra. Citizens sit around listening to Tchaikovsky.
I assume so. Well, but I must tell you about the valves. One of the more notable things about the valves was that traditionally they had a mean time between failure of about 1,000 hours. So that means if you've got 2,000 of them, you'd assume one of them would give up about every 30 minutes. However, as long as you keep them, look after them, warm them up gradually, as we've seen, and so on, they can last longer. But every now and then, you'll get an intermittent fault in one of the valves, and this will be very irritating. So the person in charge of the computational laboratory, Frank Hurst, made a thing where he had a rubber stopper on the end of a stick. One would run a test program and go along the back of the valves and go bong, 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 like a xylophone. And if you hit the one that was intermittent, the thing would stop. And then you pull that one out and put a new one in. So it was a form of impulse testing, as you might say. And I think in the Museum of Victoria, they might still have the little rubber hammer.
You've got to find it. Please, Peter, you've got to find it. Look, thank you for joining us on the show, but I mean, I hope you are in full operating condition at the age of 85.
Well, I'm still, as they say, warm and vertical, and I'm looking forward to being at this event and possibly to be around for the 75th as well.
Well, I think the lesson to us all is to warm our valves slowly, don't you?
Yes. Start slowly and warm up, and don't operate too quickly.
Peter, thank you for joining us on Late Night Live.
You're very welcome.
I've been talking to Dr. Peter Thorne, former head of the Department of Computer Science at the University of Melbourne, who has grown up with CIRAC, this ancient machine, which is still there in Australia, one of the oldest computers in the world. This is Late Night Live. And that's the show. On our next, an hour with Henry Reynolds, who's done more than any other historian to shape our understanding of this country's colonial past. He joins the show to talk about his latest book, Looking from the North, Australian History from the Top Down. North of Capricorn, he argues, is a different country that needs to be understood in its own terms. As always with Henry Reynolds, exciting ideas, beautifully written.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.